Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Haldit. Coming up in a few minutes, WFPL's Heidi Caravan speaks with Kentucky Department of Education spokesperson Lisa Gross about the department's annual summer food program for school children. First, more than 50 nurses throughout the region were in Louisville recently for a seminar on a new organization called the Registered Nurses Response Network, or RNRN. The organization was created following the devastation in the Gulf region from Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Members say RNs had difficulties then trying to volunteer in Louisiana and surrounding areas because of a lack of organization among agencies. WFPL's Julie Goodwin spoke with RNRN Director Bonnie Castillo, VA Hospital Staff Nurse Sarah Waters, and Nashville-based cardiac nurse Sue Levitan about the new organization.
Bonnie, if you can tell me a little bit about the Disaster Response Network, what is it and what is the importance of this?
Well, the RN Response Network was started out of our experience in responding to Hurricane Katrina and Rita. The California Nurses Association and National Nurses Organizing Committee, what happened was we were hearing from our members that they were having a tremendous amount of difficulty figuring out how to get down there. They were going through the advertised channels that they were seeing and just hitting many roadblocks. We thought as an organization that perhaps that we could navigate through those more effectively. And what we found is when we did try to go through the formal sort of channels in agencies, that we ran into those roadblocks. So what we did was we started to call providers directly on the ground. And when we were able to reach them, whether it was in a shelter, clinic, or hospital, we heard a whole different story, and that was, we need you. When can you get down here? So we went into action right away, and over the ensuing months sent over 300 nurses to a variety of settings, and you know, from a whole all kinds of nurses from various different kinds of clinical settings from California, but also nationally. Now, what we realized is that while we felt like we did a good job, that we wanted to be more effective, and we thought about in it, rather than waiting for a disaster to occur, that we would form a network, a broad-based network of nurses from every single state, and ultimately be able to respond even more effectively geographically. You know, for instance, nurses in Kentucky would be very important. Probably it would be a lot easier to mobilize nurses from Kentucky to Memphis should they have a big earthquake. Likewise, in California, if we were to something was to happen, you know, we'd probably be looking at neighboring states, Texas, Nevada.
And so you actually went down to the hurricane-stricken area. Tell me a little bit about exactly where you were and what you did and how you got involved.
I went in November, right after Katrina, and I got involved by looking for an organization to get down there with, and CNA had sent me a card. So I called them and called them until I got an answer, because I wasn't going to take, you know, I wasn't going to not go. I needed to go. That's the way I felt. After seeing, and I'm sure everybody saw those pictures of those people, I don't think there was a nurse in the country that felt helpless. You know, we just needed, nurses needed to get down to Katrina. But anyway, let me think. You're losing my train of thought here. But when I went down to New Orleans, and I was there for a little over a week. And what I did was, I first started out in a clinic, and people were strolling in off the streets every minute. I mean, we were giving vaccinations for tetanus or whatever they needed. A lot of them had not had medication for weeks at a time. There was so much depression, it was really heartbreaking. And then I went on to go into the mobile clinic. And what we did with that is we went to different areas that people were still there, because there were a lot of areas where people, I mean, it was ghost towns. There was no people around. But we just went into different areas, and we would just sit on the corner and wait for people to come. And a lot of people came, and the same thing with depression, the medications, and we just did the best we could for them with what we had. So,
looking back now, are there some things that you saw happen that you wish would have been a little bit different in terms of the organization of trying to get there and the types of roadblocks you had to deal with?
If we had what we're trying to do now with RNRN, I mean, we would have been there a lot quicker. And that was really the key, was the timeliness of getting down there. And we failed with Katrina. And that's what we're trying to do with RNRN, is to, if and when the next disaster strikes, we'll be ready.
Sarah, you attempted to go down to help with hurricane relief, but you faced some difficulties getting there. Is that correct?
Basically, it was a friend of mine who's also a nurse, and I decided we really needed to go down there and help. We had a bit of time off, so we got on the Internet. We got on the phone. We called every kind of agency that we thought could possibly use us. We couldn't get through to some, but when we did get through, we were told that we were not needed. And then I got a magazine from the California Nurses and saw that they had gotten through in a very direct manner, that what they had done was directly contact who needed help instead of trying to work the bureaucratic maze of already in place organizations. They didn't seem to have a plan to get people where they needed to go fast, and that's what was needed. And to read how big a difference 30 nurses at a time that they were sending in some places made not only to the lives of the people that were obviously in huge distress, but also to the lives of other nurses who were going crazy, you know, not able to see their families, not able to sleep. So it just, when I heard about the RN organization there, they started up, I had to join.
Bonnie, are there some policy issues here in terms of working with lawmakers and something that needs to be done at that level?
You know, given that the California Nurses Association and the National Nurses Organizing Committee does have a solid base, a foundation of, we represent over 70,000 nurses for the purposes of collective bargaining, that means that we're a very established organization in terms of government relations, communications, research, and in advocating on for public policy that focuses solely on patients and nurses in practice. So we've introduced we have legislation, some federal legislation that we're working on introducing that will even encompass some of the disaster components that we think are important, such as release time for nurses, that is a release by employers that would be paid, that they would be able to come back to their jobs, same benefits, no loss of benefits. Because we did hear that, you know, there were other nurses that went with other organizations where if they went for any length of time, sometimes they faced problems when they came back. So we're looking at that kind of legislation. And we also, like I said, we know that because of the lack of health care pre-disaster, that it really just compounded the impact of the disaster really was. And so we're looking We are supporting other legislation like the Sheila Kuehl bill in California, and the, which is 841, and that's a universal standard of care. The Conyers bill, which is a national bill, H.R. 676, which is a universal single standard of care health care bill. So, yes, we are operating in kind of multiple arenas.
That was WFPL's Julie Goodwin talking with members of the newly formed Registered Nurses Response Network. Thousands of Kentucky children are fed through food programs during the school year, but what happens during vacation months? Well, for the third year in a row, the Kentucky Department of Education is organizing a summer food program where children can get nutritious meals when school's not in session during those summer months. Kentucky Department of Education spokesperson Lisa Gross talked with WFPL's Heidi Caravan about the program.
Explain the Summer Food Service Program.
The Summer Food Service Program is actually a federal program that is connected to the National School Lunch and Breakfast Program. And what the Summer Food Program tries to do is to provide nutritious meals to children outside the regular school setting. And this can be in community centers or in summer camps or any of the many ways that community organizations provide either activities or a place to go for children in the summer.
How does this work? Is it breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
Usually, companies or organizations that participate in the summer food program will offer at least two meals a day, and they may also offer snacks. It depends on how long they offer whatever other services they are offering to children. So if it's a program that's open all day, it may offer up to two full meals and at least one or two snacks. And that's going to vary depending on the services that the organization offers.
How did this start?
This is something that started from the National School Lunch and Breakfast Program, which, as you may know, is a very successful program, reaches a lot of students. For instance, in Kentucky, more than 50% of our public school students are eligible for this program. And it was so successful in providing nutritious meals to students, either at low price or no price, that the federal government decided that this was something that they should try to expand to months when school was not in session. And so the summer food program was born. And this is something that states actually administer. The money is federal money, but it comes through a state agency. And in this case, of course, it's the Kentucky Department of Education.
Now, you've determined that there are three unserved Kentucky counties, Gallatin, Green, and McCrary. How is that determined?
We look at the number of people, number of students who are eligible for free and reduced price lunches, and then we look at history, and we look at the kinds of services that are currently available in those areas. And right now, those three counties, Gallatin, Green, and McCrary, really don't have a lot of organizations that are volunteering to sponsor these programs. And so they have a real need for this. Throughout Kentucky, more than 50,000 students, in fact, upwards of 60,000 children, students in public schools, children that are not students in public schools, benefit from the summer food program every year, and the goal is to expand that to capture as many kids as possible who might need the service.
Now, what about if someone says, well, you know, we have a need here in Fayette County or Jefferson County. What do you do there? Do you do a study to make sure that the needs are covered in those counties?
We do look at what services are currently being offered. We look at the need, how many children would qualify for free or reduced price meals, and then we make sure that we look at all of the resources that are available. As a rule, the larger areas, such as Louisville and Lexington, tend to have more participation simply because there are more organizations out there that are able to participate. It's when you get into the smaller counties that don't have larger cities that you run into a problem with a lack of the ability to provide the services.
Lisa, tell us how it works as far as sponsorship.
An organization would sign on to be a sponsor, and that means, of course, paperwork, because this is a federal program, and there's lots of paperwork involved. But they get reimbursed for the meals that they serve to students. And just as an example, you might have a community center that's open during the summer hours when parents are at work, and students go there and stay while their parents are at work so they don't have to stay home alone. If they stay there from, say, 8 o'clock in the morning until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, then they would at least get breakfast and probably lunch, and then snacks in between as well. So the organization that sponsors this would keep track of all the students that eat the food that they serve, and then, of course, they would turn in their paperwork and get reimbursed for the amount of money that they spend.
Where do you get the food?
The food can come really anywhere. There are many groups that have contracted with food providers. There are sometimes schools get involved. They, of course, have the equipment available, so schools could go ahead and provide the food. Even though students aren't in session, they could use the equipment to make the food. And sometimes, depending on how many meals an organization will offer, no cooking might be involved. If they're just offering, say, a breakfast and a snack, they might not need to cook that kind of food. So it's going to vary from place to place as to where they get that and how it's prepared.
If a sponsor wants to take part, what should they do?
The first thing is to contact our Division of Nutrition and Health Services. The phone number for that division is 502-564-5625, or they can email Steve Smith in that division, and Steve's email address is steve.smith@education.ky.gov. And Steve can help anybody who's interested in being a sponsor for one of these programs work through all of the requirements that you have to meet.
If you don't find enough for Gallatin Green and McCreary counties, what will happen? Is there a way to spread things out further so all Kentucky 120 counties are served?
It's really difficult when there aren't organizations available, and that may be the case in some of these counties. Of course, there also are usually social services agencies within those counties that are already offering some sort of support. It's possible to reach out to nearby counties as well who may be able to provide some help in those counties that have the greatest need. But if there's none available, then there may be children who don't get full meals during the summer, and that's a terrible thing to think of in a country that is as wealthy as this country and in a state that has as many natural resources as we do.
Speaking of the country as a whole, where does Kentucky rank as far as the summer food programs?
We rank pretty highly, and that's because we have such a large number of students that are eligible for the free and reduced price meals under the federal program. Kentucky, although they don't rank states one by one, Kentucky is up in the top 20 of states that actually participate in the program.
Do all states participate?
Most states do, because most states have at least a sizable portion of their population that is qualified for the free and reduced price meals.
Can an individual volunteer to help out with this program?
An individual might be able to offer some services, and if anyone is interested, they can contact Steve Smith in the Division of Nutrition and Health Services to get more information about that.
Lisa Gross with the Kentucky Department of Education, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
That was the Kentucky Department of Education's Lisa Gross. She spoke with WFPL's Heidi Caravan about the summer food program. More information is available at our website. Go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619 under Select a Program. When we come back, WFPL's Robin Fisher speaks with David McCauley about his books and the corresponding exhibit at the Speed Art Museum. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up a little later in the show, WFPL's Stephanie Sanders speaks with composer Bruce Adolph. His compositions will be featured this weekend at a Louisville Orchestra concert for children. First, though, have you ever wondered what happens underneath a city, or how a thermometer works, or how about the way in which a cathedral is built or a shipwreck is recovered? Author and illustrator David McCauley not only wondered, he set out to find out the answers to these questions and more. WFPL's Robin Fisher talked with David McCauley about his books and the current Speed Art Museum exhibit, Building Books, The Art of David McCauley.
I want to ask you a little bit about your background. Your background is in architecture, and obviously you have a bent toward engineering. How did you end up writing books instead of, say, building skyscrapers or office buildings?
Well, you know, I think by my fourth year of architecture school, by the end of my fourth year, I was pretty sure I didn't actually want to practice architecture. I don't know whether it was the fear of, you know, sort of being locked in one of those offices in a cubicle or whatever, working in a, now it would be working in front of a computer screen the whole time. I wanted something a little more liberating, a little freer, and picture book illustration seemed like an interesting way to go. I had some friends who encouraged me, and I was, you know, attracted to picture books, and so I started trying to write some stories.
And what did your family think? Did they go, oh, no, we thought it was going to be an architect?
No, my family has never sort of tried to predict what any of their kids would do. They just encouraged. I've always been makers of things. And, you know, they instilled in us an appreciation for how things are made and so on and so forth. But there was no sort of predetermined notion about what things we would make. It was just an interest in the idea of making things. And it began perhaps with me with buildings But it, you know, quickly changed to something of, on a smaller scale, a more manageable scale. And while picture books aren't easy by any stretch, they're a lot less complicated than trying to build a building.
Your first book was Cathedral.
Yes.
And what prompted that?
I didn't actually, well, I'll tell you what didn't prompt it was the desire to do a book about architecture. I wanted to do a fantasy story about gargoyles and gargoyles coming to life. And I needed a background. I needed a setting. So I chose medieval France and a half-finished cathedral. I made some sketches. I showed them to my editor in Boston. He is now. He wasn't then and has been since then. And he said, well, you know, this gargoyle stuff is kind of familiar. It's sort of been done. But nobody's talking about these cathedrals, this building. Why don't you tell us about the building? So it was really that conversation and his straightforwardness that pushed me back into what I knew about, which was architecture and some, to some extent, architectural history. So I forgot the gargoyles and just decided to try to tell the story of how a cathedral gets built.
Well, it truly is awe-inspiring to look at the pictures, the drawings from Cathedral, because you really feel like you're there.
Well, if you haven't seen the buildings, it's a pale comparison to the actual architecture. I mean, the real buildings are extraordinary. And you, no matter what your religious background, when you walk into one of those structures, you have to feel something. I mean, you just a sort of wonder, I think, at what people have been able to create and build permanently.
I once said that I felt when I walked into the Hagia Sophia that
yeah.
I would have been afraid to not believe in that God.
Yeah, I think whether it's a mosque, a cathedral, some of the more elaborate temples, what those buildings bring out the best of people. And they are meant to last forever, which is why they bring out the best. And they really inspire a kind of faith in humanity and the capability of humanity as much as anything else.
I want to stick with the architecture books for a few seconds and talk about mosque.
Sure.
You had written the book after 9/11.
Yeah.
To help show how people are alike. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think, well, I started it about 3 or 4 days after 9/11 because I was, like most people, probably trying to figure out how to make sense of what had just happened. And my reaction was, I need more information, basically. We all probably need more information. And so I thought this may be an opportunity to go back to the architecture series and put one more book on the shelf, which I had not originally intended to do. I think that these buildings, the fact that they have stood for as long as they have stood, the fact that they are intended to sort of elevate the human spirit, is what unifies mosques and cathedrals and so on. They transcend the differences, and they underscore the similarities between people's desires to achieve something of permanence and something that reaches higher than they perhaps thought as individuals they could reach.
Well, one thing that struck me about mosque was that it was in color.
Yeah.
And I found it to be very humanizing, and that softened the pictures.
Well, I think it does, but the primary reason was the interiors of those buildings are completely filled with color. And whether it's the tile work or painting or carving, they're rich. Now, it's true that the cathedrals, much of the cathedral interior and exterior, the statuary at least, was painted in full color. But we've gotten used to seeing cathedrals the color of stone because the paint is pretty much gone, except in little sort of recesses and distant corners. But in the mosque, when you walk into the mosques of Istanbul, for instance, I mean, you are struck by vast surfaces of beautifully colored tile. And I thought, I can't do this book without color. I mean, it would not make any sense.
It reminded me quite a bit of the Blue Mosque.
Yeah. Between the Blue Mosque, Hagia Sophia, the Suleimania, I mean, each of those is a spectacular structure. But I went for a small mosque, relatively speaking, small neighborhood mosque, because I wanted to talk not just about the building, that particular building, but about its influence on the surrounding neighborhood. I mean, just sort of visually suggest how it became part of the neighborhood and how these buildings, as part of a complex of buildings, were intended to revitalize, in many cases, the neighborhoods into which they were established.
Now, your architecture books took a somewhat of a different turn at one point, and you went underground.
Again, my curiosity.
What was that like?
It was fascinating. It was the first time I actually could not go to a library and simply get the information I needed off the shelf before going and visiting the various structures that I wrote about. For underground, I actually had to introduce myself to the people at the water department and the sanitation department and so on and so forth. And ask them the questions. I became an interviewer, which I had never done before, and basically just pulled that book together from the information I was told, and went down with them underground and into a sewer manhole here or there and that sort of stuff. It was a wonderful experience, and I think of it as my first original book, my first book that sort of created its own niche on the library shelf, whereas the others went next to cathedral and Roman history and stuff like that.
Well, another one of your books that is very original and not found in information not found in a library is Ship.
Ship is a favorite of mine, because, again, working with experts and trying to tell their story, not only is Ship the story of what archaeologists do and how they go about doing it, but it's also a story about history in a way, because it's being in two parts. The second part of the book is the story of the ship whose remains were found by the archaeologists in the first half of the book, and you begin to see how history books get written. I mean, it's not as if all of this information is absolutely hard and fast. There are gaps, there are spaces that historians have to bridge somehow. And in bridging them, they create a kind of coherent, cohesive picture of a time, of a place. And that becomes the history that we all read about. But it's important to remember that, you know, history is, in a sense, made up by the people who write about it.
Well, I found it fascinating because that is really, I think, the one part of the exhibit that shows the building of a book.
Yeah.
And you would see the section where you had the journal of the ship that had been lost at sea, but at the same time you had the instructions and the letters from the recovery effort that was going on.
Exactly, and that's a very long process. It's been shortened, obviously, to avoid putting people to sleep who come to the show. But the number of sketches and that we traveled to Brazil, we traveled to Mexico. That's one of the great things about doing these books. You do get to see some wonderful places and meet some fascinating people. But we spent a good week in Brazil in a shipbuilding town in Bahia, in northern Brazil. And it was just extraordinary. And we would go to the shipyard every day, and they were building a big replica of the Niña out of wood. And it was based on all the latest archaeological information. And so it was being put together with great accuracy, and I was lucky enough to be able to see this thing half-finished. So it became the basis of many of the drawings that appear in that book.
And you actually went down. You actually scuba down to the...
Yeah, to a wreck site off Cancun. I'd never had a scuba tank on my back before that particular trip. And so one day I was in the pool of the hotel learning how to use a snorkel, which was a first. The next day, we were out underwater with a tank on my back. So it was a kind of speedy lesson, which I obviously survived because I'm talking to you today. But, again, the experiences, being underwater, why is that important? If I'm going to make drawings of people swimming around underwater and moving things and so on and so forth, I want to remember what it felt like to try to move underwater, what it sounded like to be underwater and that sort of thing, because I think it informs the pictures you make. And they just have a little more, they're a little more real.
Do you ever think, gosh, I have a cool job?
Oh, I think about it every day. I mean, I realize that every single day. When I have a beautiful studio here, and I just love being here.
Well, the show starts with the new way things work.
Yep.
And which is, I'm sure a lot of our listeners will be familiar with that book. And
I would tell you, it was my first experience with the book, and there is some serious information there with such a wonderful sense of whimsy. And one thing I kept wondering is, how do you start? Do you get an idea and you say, okay, I want to do something on, the gears in a salad spinner, and well, then Neil Ardley comes and writes the text, or how does that work?
Well, that was interesting, yes, because Neil and I and David Burney were basically the team that put that book together, and Neil was the first one who established some kind of a list of possibilities. And we intentionally set out to choose things that worked in similar ways, but things that didn't look like each other. You know, so the scale would be completely different. You know, the size of a windmill I'm trying to think of the comparisons now. Basically, anything that spins on an axle, whether mm-hmm. you use wind or water to turn it or electric power to turn it, that notion of rotating an axle. These contraptions may look totally different, but there are aspects of the principles behind them that are very similar, that unify them. So that's how the book was that's how the subjects were chosen. And then they were organized around those similar principles. My job was to two things. First of all, to learn about the machine. I didn't know much about these machines when we started the book. And second, to interpret what I had learned so that it would be not only clear and self-explanatory, but if possible, and when possible, a little lighthearted, a little playful, so that you were, getting people interested in technology and machinery is not the easiest thing in the world, and that includes me.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got a smile on your face when you're confronting some sort of a contraption you don't really understand and are not sure you should trust, you're more likely to relax and let the information in.
So what's with the woolly mammoth?
The woolly mammoth was a sort of, he wandered in. He literally wandered in one day. I was sketching. I was trying to figure out how to make levers interesting, visually interesting, without making the same old dreary diagrams. And I thought, well, levers have been around for a long time, probably since cave people. So I did a little sketch, really rough sketch of cave people standing around a rock and a log. Which they would put, the log would go on the rock, and you'd have the rock, and you'd have a lever. And then in the back, I put some trees and whatever, just some cave stuff. And I drew a little mammoth. And then I thought, wait a minute, mammoth. Maybe they could weigh the mammoth. Maybe they could put the mammoth on one end of the lever, one end of the log, and then all the villagers could get on the other end of the log. And they could see at what point the log was horizontal. It would be the same. The weight of the villagers equals the weight of the mammoth. That's how it started. It sort of accidentally, one afternoon in the studio, after probably a year or more of trying to come up with sort of playful and interesting and engaging ways of making this material interesting.
Well, the wonderful thing about the mammoth is that he looks out of the page at the reader.
Yeah.
You know, the on milking a mammoth, and he's looking at the reader like, what are they doing to me?
The mammoth is a victim, no question about it. A victim of human ingenuity and so on, and a playful foil.
Yeah, he is very playful. He's absolutely charming. I don't want to really talk about any more books in the exhibit because there's so much to see. I don't want to give anything away. I do want to say, though, that Angelo made me cry.
Well, Angelo is a book. I turned 60 last year, and I don't think I could have done that book when I was 40. Or maybe some people can, but I couldn't. It's getting older and sort of understanding life a little bit more and thinking about things maybe a little more deeply. So, and having a chance to do, the nice thing about what I do is I choose the projects I work on. And I decided it would be, I love the city of Rome. And any opportunity to sort of set a story in that city and make drawings of that city, I'm going to go for. So I began to play with it,
Well, it was lovely.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with author and illustrator David McCauley. Building Books, the Art of David McCauley, will be on display at the Speed Art Museum through May 13th. For more information, go to speedmuseum.org or to our website, wfpl.org. When we come back, we'll hear from composer Bruce Adolph about writing music for children and how music can educate as well as entertain. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Composer Bruce Adolph will be one of the featured composers this weekend at the Louisville Orchestra's concert at the Brown Theater. It's part of its series of concerts geared toward children called Orchestra. The orchestra will perform two of Adolph's compositions, Oceanophony and Tyrannosaurus Sue. Adolph will be in Louisville later this week to attend the concert, introduce the pieces, and answer audience questions. He spoke with WFPL's Stephanie Sanders.
Tell me how it's different composing music for children as compared to adult audiences.
Well, composing music for kids is a lot of fun, actually, because I carry around my childhood with me all the time, and I enjoy thinking of myself in the audience. I think one of the fun things about composing for children for me is that I can still picture myself at the right age in the audience and how I would feel and react to things. In fact, sometimes I have more fun writing for kids because they are both very receptive and very critical in a good way, but not judgmental, and they have less experience, so that their reactions are really kind of true with a capital T. So very often for an adult audience, you know, they see there's a new work and some people are very excited about that and some are already nervous or upset and they have all these attitudes, good and bad, that they bring to it. With kids, actually, are just completely open most of the time and waiting to hear what you've done. So I think of that, and it sometimes is freeing and kind of liberating to know that the audience is like that. And they want to be entertained and they want excitement, but they're also able to, as long as it's not too long, go into something that is quite serious and elegant and beautiful. They can, you can take them anywhere, really, because they are willing to go. So I have more fun. It also bears into children's concerts. I mean, people who give them know that they can be funnier, they can talk to the audience freely, they can expose their ideas more openly than they often can with adults who are, for the most part, adults bring certain expectations, which you either meet or fail to meet, whereas kids don't really bring those expectations. So in that sense, it's fun. As far as musical technique and sophistication, I actually keep the level the same. I like to challenge kids, and I like to make the music exciting for professional musicians to play and for even for my musical colleagues to hear. So the music I write for kids is not kiddie music at all. It's sophisticated, it's technically and emotionally as vivid as and challenging as I can make it. The only differences are that I often am telling a story with the music, which I don't necessarily do otherwise, and also that I tend to make the movements more concise, a little bit shorter, partly because even when I write something that's 5 or 6 minutes, that is longer than most popular songs and most things that they're exposed to. I think kids have a better attention span than they're often given credit for, but I do have to deal with what they're used to hearing.
Yeah, I was just talking a few minutes ago when I was getting ready to come in here and interview you with some people in the newsroom about how when I was in college and in the orchestra and in the symphony band there, how much I enjoyed playing pieces that were written for performance for kids, because you get to do things with your instrument in those circumstances to create kind of that musical imagery that you don't normally get to do, right?
Well, sometimes. I think what happens, actually, is that some people perform better for kids because they are more in touch with the idea of musical imagery, which should be there all the time, but something about kids in the audience frees you up to be your most creative, and I think that really if one played like that all the time, that adult audiences would enjoy it just as much. I mean, a really great artist plays the same way for everybody, but does respond to some energy in the audience. But just what the words you used of the imagery in your playing, that is something that a great artist always has in mind, and I think that kids bring that out of more people. So actually playing concerts for an attentive young audience is a great way to improve your playing.
How did you get started? Maybe what was your first piece, and how did you get started writing music for children?
Well, I was writing for many years before I wrote anything for kids. And I think the first time was in the early 80s when people at the 92nd Street Y in New York, which is actually a big theater that presents a lot of music as well as being a Y, commissioned me to write something for the New York Chamber Symphony with kids participating. And I guess the conductor at that time heard some of my music and thought that kids would, or thought that I would be able to write something that kids would respond to. So not having done anything like that, I wrote several short pieces which had recurring melodic ideas or rhythmic ideas and various things that could be performed by the audience. And what happened was there were 1,000 kids in the audience, and they had rehearsed a lot. And when I got there, I really was just bowled over by how fantastic the feeling was of those kids and their energy and their excitement about the music. And after that, I started to look for opportunities to do it. And I had quite a few, and then the next one that was meaningful really was commissioned by the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center right before I got the job as being the education director there, which I did for 8 years. And after that, it just spiraled until Julian Pfeiffer, who was for 27 years the executive director of the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, asked me to write a children's educational work for the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. And after that was done, the piece was called The Purple Palace. He and I started imagining all the things that you can do with this. I mean, there could have been visuals, there could be a book, there could be accompanying materials for teachers, there could be a packaged product for parents to give to kids. And we realized that there wasn't much of that going on. There might be now and then something like that, but there was no company that devoted itself to that. So we started one, which is called Polyrhythm Productions, about 7 years ago. And Tyrannosaurus Sue was the first thing we did. And Oceanophony came along a few later. And now there are, I think, 15 or so pieces that have educational qualities that are directed for family concerts.
And then I know with Oceanophony, I'm not sure if it's true with Tyrannosaurus Sue, but you include poetry in the performance. Is that correct?
Yes. Tyrannosaurus Sue does not have poetry. It has brief descriptions of what's happening in the scene that I wrote myself in order to just open up the mind of the listener so they can picture what's going on. And I did check all the paleontology out with the people at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, where the piece was first performed. And for Oceanophony, I contacted Kate Light, who is a poet, and she had never written anything for kids before, but I felt she could do it, and she did. And what we did there was construct pieces that essentially, you learn a little bit about the science of the ocean, then you hear a poem about the ocean, and then you hear a piece that goes with it. And it became a large work because of that. So there are many poems and many pieces and also lots and lots of information about the ocean. So you learn about music and you learn about the sea, and you are in a way also learning about poetry.
I imagine teachers probably love this because it incorporates so many things as well as music and education. So, I mean, what kind of feedback have you gotten from teachers about this?
Well, we've had a lot of success with teachers because it gives them so much to chew on, and it goes way beyond meeting the standards that so many of them teach to. I mean, we have, with these two pieces, you know, there's science in both of them, and the science is there explained, and it's useful for them right there. They don't have to go look things up. And the poetry can be used to teach writing. The music is full of imagery and ideas that can be used to help kids listen to music better and get introduced to ideas of really good listening in general. And you put it all together, and you can bring science teacher together with an English teacher, together with a history or a natural history teacher or a science teacher, or one person can do it. Or it can just be used, for example, by the music class. It can just be used in a science class, but it's a great way to make it fun and make it multi-layered. And as I said, with all 15 of these projects that we've got, it covers many other things, like the visual arts and Shakespeare and Native Americans. I mean, it's just we're really trying to open it up as broadly as possible and keep going. In fact, I've got two projects now that are going to be about brain science, being written with me by a renowned neurologist, and one that's going to be about outer space, written with a text by the physicist Brian Greene. And the neurologist is Antonio Damasio, who is one of the leading writers about consciousness and the brain and the mind in the world. So we've really expanded to include and are continuing to include more and more aspects of education that are in, that are kind of wrapped up and packaged with music and other arts.
And you're going to be in Louisville during this performance on the 17th. I guess what is your role in the event going to be?
Well, I'm definitely going to talk to the audience about the music and what to listen for and give them some clues about the instruments and the way I use them and how the themes relate. For example, the Octopus Octet has eight voice theme. It's a fugue, which I can explain what that is to them, and it has eight entrances, so that the theme actually represents the tentacles of the octopus. And there are some other things that go on with it. And all of the pieces have very simple, clear relationship between the music and the imagery, and in some cases even the science. So I'm going to explain those things simply as possible. And I also will take questions afterwards. And I believe when it comes to Tyrannosaurus Sue, I'll also read the introduction that goes with it.
All right, great. Bruce Adolph, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you.
More information on Bruce Adolph, the Louisville Orchestra, and its orchestra series is available at our website, wfpl.org. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's show, go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.